Daniel Kuzuhara's performance of My Heart Will Go On brings us to the end of this morning's broadcast. Duke Ellington's 1927 Down in Our Alley Blues takes us out. I'm Rich Samuels. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the 8 o'clock buzz.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for the BBC News.
Hello, I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. Myanmar's isolated military government has made a rare request for international help after a powerful earthquake hit the centre of the country. The quake's epicentre was near the city of Mandalay, home to 1.5 million people. Communication networks are down in many parts of the country. Our Asia Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton reports.
A spokesperson in Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw, told the French news agency that humanitarian aid was needed as soon as possible. Government-run hospitals are overwhelmed, and the authorities are already appealing for blood donations. A 1,000-bed hospital in Naypyidaw has been declared a mass casualty area. The military government says that two bridges have collapsed and buildings in five cities and towns have also been damaged. The U.S. Geological Survey says, judging by the size of the quake, thousands could have been killed in Myanmar.
The authorities in the Thai capital Bangkok have declared the city a disaster area after strong tremors from the earthquake in Myanmar damaged buildings. Rescuers are trying to reach dozens of workers trapped in the rubble of a construction site where a skyscraper collapsed. The city's governor says many other buildings have been affected. Tom Beeston was in a high-rise office building in Bangkok when the earthquake struck.
You have that moment where you don't really know what's happening, then it suddenly clicks, like, oh, this is an earthquake. We kind of got under our desk, duck cover, and then there was that weird period where, because we were so high up, we were like, are we better off sheltering here, or should we kind of try and get downstairs as quickly as possible? So then before we knew it, we were all rushing down the stairs as fast as we can with, you know, hundreds of other people around us. And yeah, it was chaos.
The Israeli military has struck a building in a neighbourhood in southern Beirut. Earlier, the army had told residents in the suburb of Dahiya to evacuate. Online footage appeared to show people fleeing in panic. From Beirut, here's Hugo Bashega.
This is the first Israeli airstrike on Beirut's southern suburbs since a ceasefire with Hezbollah came into force in November. The attack happened hours after two rockets were fired from southern Lebanon towards northern Israel. The Israeli military said it had intercepted one of the rockets while the other failed to cross the border. Hezbollah said it was not involved in the attack, the second from Lebanon in a week. The latest developments put further pressure on the fragile ceasefire, but for now, the deal is likely to survive.
Lebanon and Syria have signed an agreement to address security issues and military movement along their common border. The two countries' defence ministers met in Saudi Arabia on Thursday night, and according to Saudi media, they agreed on the demarcation of their frontier and the establishment of specialised committees to oversee security threats. You're listening to World News from the BBC.
WORT is excited to be in our 50th year, and to help celebrate, we are hosting the opening night of Madison's newest venue, the Atwood Music Hall. Join us on Friday, June 13th, for a great night honoring Clyde Stubblefield. The night features performances from Mama Dig Down's Brass Band, The Funky JBs, VO5, Rare Element, DJ Trevor Banks, and Kaboombox. Andy Moore from the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz will host the evening celebrating 50 years of WORT and the grand opening of Madison's newest venue at 1925 Winnebago Street. Proceeds from the evening benefit WORT. Tickets are $25 in advance and available now at theatwoodmusichall.com. Be sure to shine up your dancing shoes and grab your tickets before they're gone.
Election Day is around the corner next Tuesday. WORT has interviewed candidates for City Council, and we've put together a candidate guide with those interviews and more. Find it online at WORTFM.org/candidates and find what you need to be ready to vote. That's at myvote.wi.gov. Say it's my country.
It's a Friday 8 o'clock buzz. It's March 28. I'm a little discombobulated. I'm Andy Moore. I'm discombobulated. I got in here what I think they call around here Jonathan Zaroff late. So obviously not late because here we are. It's 8:06 and we're on the air. But when I woke up, I forgot that I didn't have a car today, and I've been driving since the cold weather, and today since it's 83 out, you know, it really doesn't matter. But my wife has a car, speaking of which, good morning to listeners up in Three Lakes if you're tuned in. So I biked in and a complete discombobulation. Then during the theme song, I get a text from the guy running the NCAA bracket pool that I'm in. So this was just 20 seconds ago, reminding me, this is sort of like twisting the knife, especially for a guy that doesn't have very good brackets. It reminded me that I still owe him $10 for entering the bracket. So that was a little discombobulating. And you know, for a guy with bad brackets, I really shouldn't ride Greg Gard, but I can't resist. We have another season, folks. In the books, another UW men's basketball season in the books, another loss in the second round, right? It was a tough season, at least for people like me who wish Gard had never stepped foot in the Kohl Center. That's because, and this will have to be my last rant until November when he's back, but he'll do it again because he did it again this season. A more than respectful conference season, creating great games with hodgepodge players, then going home to Madison after the second round. You know, It's not all bad, because Madison's a nice place to come home to. There's just one problem. Gard keeps coming back and back. His seat, though, as you well know, is as safe in the Kohl Center as Robin Voss's is in the State Assembly. Why? I wish I could tell you. I feel like I'm a pretty smart guy, but I can't tell you. The only reason I can conceive, the only reason I can think of, is he consistently gets the Badgers into the first or second round of the NCAA tournament. And that seems to be plenty for Badger fans. Never mind Big Ten play, although that also factors into the safest position. Badger fans are excited about conference rankings. They seem not to care as much about how that other tournament goes. What is it called? The Division I National Championships. Gard gets a pass for his record there. And what is his record? This is Gard's national tournament record since 2017. 2017 out in the Sweet 16. 2018 didn't make the tournament. 2019 out first round. There wasn't a tournament because of COVID in 2020. 2021 out second round. 2022 out second round. 2024 out first round. 2025 gone in the second round. Time marches on, doesn't it? The only three tournament wins in that time span were against an 8 seed and 2 14 seeds. Yeah, okay. Gard's a superstar at the Kohl Center, but his teams are chokers and more miles traveled from there. I shouldn't keep piling on, but you know how much he makes, don't you? $3.5 million. And he has something in common with athlete grade point averages and graduation rates. They're all obsolete. Okay, I don't know. Gard is only 54 years old. He ain't going anywhere, which is, of course, the same age as some of the portal players. But the players have to move on. Gard will not. He's here for a long, long time. Second round NCAA finishes and all. Call me mean, but I kind of like the idea of seeing the Badgers in the Final Four again before I'm too old to work the remote, okay? It ain't going to happen with Greg Gard. I'm done, Jim. That's the last Craig Guard rant, and it was probably too long, but it's that's finito. Okay. Jim, I know you're as happy about this as anyone.
Well, you know, you got to make up for all the rants that you're not able to have over the next several weeks.
I appreciate that. I'll be kind of on a starvation diet. Okay, that's the bad news. Greg Guard is here to stay. The good news, you don't have to listen to me rip on poor old Greg Guard again for 8 months. And the other good news is we have a great show at 8:45. We'll be talking with St. John men's basketball coach Rick Pitino. Kidding. That's when we'll talk to Wisconsin State Journal food and culture writer Samara Kalk about new Madison trends. At half past the hour, we'll get a preview of the new Mercury Players Play with the lead actor and the co-director. And in just a minute, Washington Post political reporter Patrick Marley gives us a deep dive into the waning hours of the Crawford Schimmel race for the state's high court. Engineer without peer Jim Wilson just weighed in. DJ Spin Cycle Uncle Mel Holter is on the decks for us this morning, per usual. And our online producer, front office director Elliot LeBrun, is out there sitting in the newly painted lobby, which I thought I was in the wrong place this morning. It's the Greg Guard edition of the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Let's get buzzing.
Inside, like my heart's got a big break, and a stab of loneliness sharp and painful that I may never shake. You might think that I'm taking heart since you broke me off with a call. You might wait till that I'll hide in sorrow when I'm under a down and bow. Now the race is on, and here comes pride at the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside, my tears are holding back. Not to fall, my heart's out of the running. Too low to scratch for another sake. The race is on, and it looks like heartache, and the winner loses all.
You know, Bobby Weir is really an underrated singer. That's The Race Is On. Thank you, Ankur. And The Race Is On, as we all well know, if you have a television set or you look at anything online, if you've seen the candidate ads in the race for the open seat for the state Supreme Court, you've seen those? Between liberal Susan Crawford and conservative Brad Schimmel, both current circuit court judges. Well, if you've seen those ads, then you know that the sooner we get them both off the street will be safer. Apparently, they let sex offenders go free, and they go easy on violent criminals and generally allow chaos to rule the day. And it always happens on the airwaves that way. The campaign on the airwaves preys on fear, and, well, as we all know, fear works. So the stakes are high in the race to be decided next Tuesday, April 1, and so is the spending, including Elon Musk's multi-million dollar investment in Schimmel's high court bid. The issues are kind of important, too. And so we go over all of these things now with veteran Wisconsin political reporter Patrick Marley, formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now with the Washington Post. Patrick joins us by phone from Madison. Good morning, Patrick, and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. Let's start with the money swirling around from around the country into this race. These are record-breaking sums, are they not?
Oh, they absolutely obliterate past records. I think we've got some $80 million that's been spent on this race so far. That, you know, 2 years ago, Wisconsin set a record for any judicial race in the country ever with a $56 million race. And that was eye-popping. That, you know, by many times beat the previous record, which had been set, I don't know, a decade or two before. And now we're far surpassing what we did in 2023.
I was wondering if you could give us another sum for context. And that $56 million did seem like an impossible amount of money for a race, a statewide race. And now you said $80 million.
Yeah, and we're not, you know, the final accounting is not done. It's going to be many millions of dollars more than that. I mean, we're now talking about Wisconsin Supreme Court races costing what governor's races or U.S. Senate races can cost, at least in their, you know, final stages. So it is, you know, these kind of massive national type elections. How much that's sustained, we don't know. This is for the majority, just like it was in 2023. But it sort of sets a new standard. You're starting to see these increasingly politicized and very expensive races in other states as well.
I don't want to generalize, but when the Washington Post knew what they were doing when they approached you as a hire, because for some reason, Wisconsin is this political tornado that happens to be the Supreme Court race this time, the margins in the national races, and so on. This is a little bit off the road, Patrick, so I apologize, but you've been reporting and studying politics in the state for quite a while. What is it in the water in Wisconsin that makes us so jammed?
Yeah, I mean, we are right in the middle of a political storm all the time. I've been covering politics here for about 20 years, and it's been, it's a political journalist dream, right? Because it is always the center of the story. And the reason is simple. It's that we're a swing state. I mean, we've got a population that is very closely divided, and you look no further than Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson being the two senators from the state to show you just how closely divided the state is. The last three presidential races all decided by 1 point. And you can go back much further for very close presidential races as well.
It seems like the only thing that the two factions in Wisconsin have in common is drinking too much. But let's go back to money just for a moment. I don't want to obsess over Elon Musk, but you talk about the elephant in the room with money. This week, he picked a winner in Green Bay and handed the guy $1 million for filling out a survey.
He did. Musk recently, this is something he did in November in swing states as well, is he said, if you sign this petition, it says, I oppose activist judges, he'll give you $100. If you refer a friend, he'll give you $100. Now, this is premised on you have to give your contact information. And then his political operation can bombard those signers with information about the election, trying to get them to support Brad Schimmel and get them out to the polls. And then they enter the people who sign the petition into a lottery, and they give them $1 million. Elon Musk says he will be in Wisconsin on Sunday, and he's going to give out 2 more $1 million checks. So there's, an attempt to use this, unique or new to the scene strategy to try to get lower propensity voters involved in politics.
Some of our listeners may not like these words, but as I understand it, that's not buying votes. But that is an important purchase. It's buying names, correct?
Right. It's a way to buy data on voters. He is not saying sign a petition promising to vote for a particular candidate. It's a pretty bland statement of opposition to activist judges. But then once he has that, he's got ways to reach potential voters who he thinks are going to be aligned with his views, and he can, cross-reference that data with data the state party has and other political operators have, and both campaigns do this with data to like find the best message for those people and use it to get them to go vote.
You can't build a house without lumber, and voters are the lumber, so to speak, I suppose. Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is nonpartisan. It's almost laughable to say that now. It's become hyper-political, as we all know, a position to seek and secure. But that didn't happen overnight. It didn't. You and I both remember races where people were hands-off of issues and distanced themselves even from the two main political parties in their own ways. That wasn't that long ago. So this didn't happen overnight, this hyper-politicization of the high court. What were the ingredients, do you think, Patrick, that made that happen?
I mean, it's been a years-long development. I mean, I've covered these races since 2006, 2007, somewhere around there. And, at that time you were starting to see increased spending, more partisan ties, candidates showing up at political party events, but always like trying to do it with a little distance. And back in those years, it was, seen as a big encroachment of partisan politics into judicial races and had a lot of academics alarmed. And, if we went back and we looked at what they were doing today, it would seem quaint. I mean, now you have political parties outright endorsing candidates.
Yeah.
And because of a campaign finance law change maybe 10 years ago, the parties can pump just millions and millions of dollars into these candidates' coffers, and they do. And, you know, you had Donald Trump last night gave a telephone rally for Brad Schimmel. Barack Obama the other day endorsed Susan Crawford. So you've got the political actors fully engaged here. It's, in terms of campaigning, it's about as partisan as it can get.
Yeah, and that kind of partisanship can get down the road once someone assumes a seat, be deceiving, because, you know, a case before the high court on abortion is not necessarily, is abortion a right or not? It hardly ever is. There's those intricacies, but people are doing their best to think that they're getting what they're getting for their money, I suppose. I spoke in the intro of all the ads, and then we're talking about the money that pays them, pointing to various nightmare scenarios. But when it comes to issues like women's health care and other things, and as you've learned about the responsibility to the Supreme Court justice in your years of coverage, I hate to turn a reporter into a UW professor, but what do you think voters should be thinking of when examining a high court candidate's record for this election?
Well, I think it's important to look at their records on the types of issues that will come to the court. So, and both have records. Brad Schimmel's a former attorney general. He served one term. He's been on the court. He's a longtime prosecutor. He's taken positions on, legal positions as an attorney in those roles on things like Act 10, the union restrictions that were passed under Scott Walker, on voter ID, on abortion issues. Susan Crawford, who was an advisor, top aide to Jim Doyle when he was governor and served in private practice representing Planned Parenthood and some unions, and then a judge, she has a record on these types of issues as well. Those are the kinds of cases that come to the Supreme Court. You know, there are other issues that may light up certain voters, that get them concerned, but they're maybe less likely to come to the court. But, you know, what we know is coming to the court, it's going to decide some big abortion cases before either of these people will be seated. They're going to, the election's April 1, but they don't get seated until August 1st. But the courts this summer are going to decide, or maybe even in the spring, decide a couple of abortion cases. And those will be binding, but also, you know, the new majority could change or do something, go in a different direction depending on its makeup, but it sort of will set the new standard for what abortion policies are in the state. Act 10, the union law, that seems certain to come to the court sometime after a new justice is seated. We had the Supreme Court had to decide whether the 2020 election was legitimately held in the state. It did decide that it was, but certainly future disputes over elections, particularly close elections, will certainly come to the court.
These are very large matters, and I want to dig just an inch or two deeper into minority-majority with you in a moment. But before I do, I want to tell our listeners, if they're just joining us, we're talking about Tuesday's state Supreme Court election with Washington Post political reporter Patrick Marley. For the record, we asked both candidates in these past months, Susan Crawford and Brad Schimmel, to appear on this program, The Friday Buzz. Susan Crawford did, and her complete interview is in the WRT archives. Very easy to find. I believe that was, early last month. Brad Schimmel did not respond to our invitations. Patrick, for our listeners who are vaguely familiar with the political makeup of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and to further emphasize the stakes such as you were just describing them with regard to these big ticket cases, please put the current majority minority in context.
Sure. So for about 15 years, conservatives held a majority on the Supreme Court. In 2023, that changed when Janet Protasiewicz won an open seat on the court. That gave liberals a 4-3 majority, which they hold today. Ann Walsh Bradley, longtime court member, part of the liberal majority, is retiring. And so this is an open seat. That means whoever wins, you know, will be the difference maker in the majority. So if Susan Crawford wins, you will continue to see this 4-3 liberal majority. If Schimmel wins, you'll have a 4-3 conservative majority. If you want to go in the weeds a little bit, you tend to have one Supreme Court race every year. And so we know who's up in 26 and 27. If the liberals win on Tuesday and everybody stays on the court, they'll have a majority through 2028. So they sort of locked in for a period of time. If Schimmel wins, the conservatives will have a 4-3 majority, and then in 1 year, Rebecca Bradley will be up. She's a conservative, and so liberals would have a chance to take it back. So the stakes are very high for both sides, but the liberals, should they win, will have a more permanent majority, and the conservatives would have to fight for it within a year or in a year.
Most news consumers don't realize that reporters don't write their own headlines, so I hate to make you write headlines, but every reporter, political reporter in the country is going to be watching what Patrick Marley writes about this race next week. If the liberal succeeds, if Crawford is the victor, what will the national headline be? And similarly with Brad Schimmel.
I mean, I think either way, this is going to be a sort of pulse check on the electorate. You know, Trump won all of the swing states not too many months ago. His administration has been aggressive in doing a lot of things, and this will be a chance to see in one swing state how voters are receiving that. You know, Trump and Elon Musk, one of Trump's top advisors, have been very involved in this race, so they're really closely tied here. The Democrats have made Musk sort of their public enemy and a rallying cry to get people out to vote against Trump's agenda. So I think the election will be viewed as a sign of what direction we're headed into and where the midterms might go. Mm-hmm. Now, it is by no means a guarantee that whatever happens on Tuesday is going to happen in November of 2026. Right. That's a political lifetime, but it does sort of tell you the general trajectory. There's a couple of special elections in Florida for congressional seats. Those are pretty Republican seats.
Mm-hmm.
Very Republican. And so those will also be a check, like how do Democrats overperform there? Do they overperform so well that they could win one of them? I think, these races taken together will be sort of seen as a barometer of the mood of the country.
You mentioned your couple decade of reporting on court races. I've been thinking lately about widely accepted disinformation in people's lives now, which is something that's relatively new in American politics, as we know and are still trying to figure out. Here's a quote: "Quote, disinformation is misinformation on steroids." Unquote. That's from an editorial in your former paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, how is the storm of online disinformation complicating your job and others in the mainstream political press?
Well, disinformation definitely is on steroids now because of the vectors through which it can travel, on social media, and it just seems to have many more opportunities to get in the bloodstream of the body politic. So I would actually say in this race for state Supreme Court, we've sort of seen normal types of misinformation and disinformation. I would not say I've seen an escalation from 2024, but with the advent of AI, there's a lot of concerns about the kinds of things that can be coming in the future. It's going to get harder and harder. And it doesn't matter that it's harder for me. What matters is it's harder for readers and people in the public and, just ordinary citizens who want to know what the actual facts are. We all have to become much better at scrutinizing the information we receive because, it's not just when you're reading the newspaper or news site. It's what's on your Instagram feed or your, Blue Sky or X, wherever you are, it's hitting you from all directions. And you just got to be on constant vigilance to hey, is that really true? Mm-hmm. This thing sounds alarming. Mm-hmm. It gives me this big emotional response. Is it real? It might be, and it might be fake.
Good advice. In just a minute or so that we have left, a couple quickie questions. Are you aware of any 11th hour polling on Tuesday's race?
No, there's usually no good public polling in these races because turnout is so low that you can't really reliably poll this stuff. So, no, I don't know of anything.
I don't remember, and I totally could have missed it, any Marquette polling on this race or any recent. Did I completely miss that?
Well, Marquette did a poll maybe a month ago, but the poll question was, Do you have favorable or unfavorable opinions of each of the candidates? They didn't do a head-to-head because of that fact that so few know. And what the numbers showed us is that most voters at that time did not know enough to have an opinion of either candidate. Yeah. This is an election where really involved voters show up. You know, it's much smaller than a November election, so it's going to be a turnout election.
We tried to stay out of the weeds earlier, and I should have taken that cue. But the old saying, the power of the incumbency, Wisconsin has actually elected Schimmel to statewide office once. Mm-hmm. And there's some power in that, is there not? Kind of unavoidably.
Absolutely. He was, you know, he got elected to statewide office, and Susan Crawford has never been up for statewide office. So that's something. Now, he also lost a statewide election race, but you have to think that he started this race with more name ID, having served as attorney general for 4 years.
Well, Patrick Marley, I don't know if you're a basketball fan. You're going to need some rest here in the this weekend. But thanks for joining us on the Friday Buzz. And I hope you have a great weekend if you're not working.
Thank you, Andy. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, I hope you'll come back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Patrick Marley is a political reporter for The Washington Post, and he's got his work cut out for him. All right, from politics to the arts. Next up, Encore's live music picks for the coming weekend, and then a sneak peek at a new Mercury Players Theater production. But first, some music and some boring announcements. You're listening to WRTFM.org online. WRTFM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:31.
Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Isthmus is back on newsstands the first Thursday of every month, and now a nonprofit. Isthmus continues to expand its independent coverage of local government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. This year's festival boasts over 170 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. This year we'll be showing films at the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater, as well as four venues on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll be spending the last 4 days of the festival at Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
It's Friday at 8 o'clock. Buzz, I'm Andy Moore. You know, just because you don't have any plans for the weekend yet, you're not a loser. There's a whole world out there. It's just that you haven't had time because you're busy. And the live music calendar is jam-packed. So what are you going to do? You're going to listen to Encore's picks, and he's going to lay the whole weekend out for you for live music. But before we get to Encore's picks, here's Jim Wilson with the Encore's picks disclaimer.
Encore's picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Encore consults with an advisory board of one, Encore Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Encore, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Encore has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Encore's picks, for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Encore's picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed. Here's Encore Malhotra!
Good morning, Madison. Did you enjoy that light show this morning?
Oh yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, the sound and light show.
God, sustained thunder. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, there was a couple of hundred bolts of lightning. Got to check with Rob McClure probably to figure out what the status was with how many bolts that we got. And it was torrential. And speaking of torrents, there's going to be Fitchburg Copa show tonight with the Broken Boards, the Goobers, Silver Surfers, DJ Siggy, that's Surf Special, and then Lozars playing at Kiki's House of Righteous Music also tonight. Tomorrow, local favorites, Neil Young specialists, the Shaky, they were on our show last week.
Yep.
They play Stoughton Opera House tomorrow, Saturday, and they do two sets, and they've got steel pedal and all sorts of piano on stage as well, so it's going to be a special one. And then we have Tuvan Throat Singers, Alash, they used to be called the Alash Ensemble, but they just go by the name of Alash. Then they play tomorrow at Baroque, Saturday, March 29th. I believe they have a show tonight in Dodgeville. And then later this week, Election Day, or Voting Day, rather, I should say, is Ganavya at the Art Lit Lab, April 1. That's it, folks.
Thank you, Encore. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Oh, that was so pretty. I love the sound of my own voice, but interrupted. That's very, very pretty. Thanks for the picks. Thanks for the music, as always, Encore Malhotra. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Folks, we're about to meet Becky Foster, a middle-aged car dealership worker who is about to take a joyride of one sort or the other into some murky waters. Becky's new car is a new Mercury Players Theater production that premieres tonight at the Bartell Theater. The fact that it premieres tonight makes it a very, 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 I gotta check my notes here, very long day for the show's co-directors, Megan McGlone and Sean. I didn't jot down your last name.
Langenecker.
That was okay. That's easy for you to say.
It is.
I can hear it in your voice too. I was teasing you about that a little bit, Kelly. I thought Kelly McGlone was going to be here.
You can call
star of the
Kelly.
Show, and she and
fine.
She's sleeping in. I'm going to call Megan, Becky. I'm going to call Sean, Kelly.
Perfect.
Oh, this is a mess. I should start over. Let's rack that music up again and go all the way back to the beginning. Megan, this is a 70-minute one-act play, which sounds absolutely aerobic for the lead character. Tell us about who that character is. Who is Becky Foster?
Becky is a person who has been having her life be a little bit stagnant, just kind of working at the car dealership, and then suddenly one day something very exciting happens, and that sets off a bunch of different exciting things that are misunderstandings and close calls, and it is very, very aerobic. It is constant movement on the stage and constant brand new things being introduced.
I know our listeners are listening carefully because that's what they're good at, and they can tell that you're not giving up anything, that you won't tell us the mess that she gets in or the mess that she makes. But I do want to know, what does Becky want?
A new car. So it's obviously more than just a new car. It's a metaphor for change and for finding a new way to get where you want, I guess. And so it's just a reexamination of where she is in life and where she wants to go. And all of the characters in the play have moments of that as well. And so it's this journey to finding a new doorway to the future, I guess, and figuring out what it is you really, really want in life. When you get to middle age, which we're all sort of at right now, you reassess your priorities in life and what you're doing. And then we get to see her doing that in real time, but in a farcical manner. So it's a little bit more intense than your usual midlife crisis.
It even comes up in the play where they talk about Erickson and saying it's about generativity rather than stagnation and people moving toward generativity.
I love the symbolism of a new car. It's so American, for better and worse, of a new change, of a new start, of rolling forward in a new way. It's just packed with symbolism. Your descriptions and what little I've been able to pick up, too, just in researching for this conversation, has me thinking that this play smells a little bit like the black comedy of the vintage of Fargo, Sean. Is that off the mark?
It does have that sort of extreme element to it, where, you know, it's things that could absolutely definitely happen. I mean, it's realistic, but also it's just like, wow, this is crazy. So it's that balance of this is possible, but it's also just bananas.
How many other characters surround Becky in this story?
Six other people. Yeah. So it's her husband and her son, and then her coworker at the dealership, and then some new people that find their way into her life and cause a ruckus.
Megan, how has it been working with this specific ensemble?
It has been absolutely incredible. They are a dream to work with. They are all bringing all sorts of different insights and techniques into the space together. And it's been really great being able to work with them and for them to learn from each other.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with John Langenecker. And Megan McGlone, they're the co-directors of the Mercury Players Theater new show, Becky's New Car. The play premieres tonight at the Bartell Theater. More info and tickets at bartelltheater.org. I've been kind of anxious to ask you guys this, and I'm hoping that, you know, that I might start a fight. Megan and Sean, the position of co-director to me sounds daunting. How are your responsibilities divided up between you guys as this work in progress has led you to today's premiere?
Sean has done a lot more of the kind of nuts and bolts, like blocking type things. I've done a little bit more of the kind of work on what the characters are doing, some of the dramaturgical work. And then a lot of it is just shared because we've known each other for decades. So we've worked together for a long time, and
Well, let me ask you this. We talked to screenwriters on this show last week, and it was really provocative. You know, the film festival, everyone thinks of actors. Everyone thinks of somewhat of directors and direction. And nobody thinks about the written page. So, again, not to try to create trouble between you, but laughs especially can be interpreted in different ways with those who are in charge of directing them. What's your approach to directing for a laugh?
Well, any creative act is, I believe, a conversation with the work. And so, you know, having two people directing it, it's just another person in the chat, I guess, kind of a thing. Because you're in conversation with the script, you're in conversation with the actors, you're in conversation with the tech folks, you're in conversation with the audience in this play, literally, and directly. And so... That's an ongoing thing. It doesn't really matter how many people are involved. It's you want to continue that. So there's no real, like you said, there's many ways to play a laugh. There's no one right way to do it. And so we try it a bunch of different ways, and you can kind of feel it when that's the one.
And we give them direction sometimes, but sometimes our direction is just, wow, what you just did was unbelievably hilarious. Please keep that.
Keep it. Playing. Trying to just explore like I said, converse with the text.
I don't want to over concentrate on the script, but like I said, last week's conversation has really lingered with me. I can't remember the actor who said it, but this person said, it's not the actor's job to be funny, it's the writer's. Do you agree with that, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an actor can screw it up. I mean, they can kill a joke really easily. But if there's nothing there to begin with, it's really hard to make it. I mean, unless you're doing it ironically. I mean, you could flip that around and kind of make fun of the writers. but that's not really helpful. This script is just fascinating. I think it's a masterwork because it just moves so fast, and all of the plot points, like I said, are just so almost wildly unbelievable, but they're also very, very believable.
Yes.
That's a feat
for sure. Megan, take us inside the final hours this week of the show rehearsals. What was happening?
So one of the most exciting things that we had happen is that we are doing the play, then there's going to be an intermission, and then afterwards there's going to be Improv Invasion.
I wanted to ask you about that, yeah.
And so we've been having some of the people from Monkey Business come and watch our rehearsals so they can start to get familiar with the script, and so that they will have, you know, a bunch of really fun stuff to improvise with. So bringing in more people, getting more energy into the space, the set has come together and it is breathtaking. It is breathtakingly beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I asked, I designed the set, but I did not build it because I could not have. And so I was asking all of these designers and tech folks to do some pretty extreme things, and they did them. They did them all. They made all of our requests and dreams come true for the set. And some of them were pretty daunting.
Oh, cool. But they were realized.
Yes.
Just another beat on that, the improv. I think that the carefully listening audience picked up on that, but give us just a little more insight, because it's very unusual.
Yep,
this play that's very intact, very, you know, traditional presentation, and then followed by a number of minutes of improv. What's happening with that?
So the play is a little bit short, so we were thinking about what can we do to make this, you know, kind of a full evening of theater. And also, the play ends in this doorway kind of space, in this space of a threshold that doesn't really give you answers. So having the improvers come in afterwards and improv about taking suggestions from the audience, and then improvise using
about where
those
it
ideas.
Could go.
Yep.
So that will be the specific prompt.
Well,
from ish.
Yeah. I mean, they have a lot of ideas. I mean, it could be the B-roll of what of the timeline that did happen. Like, what were the neighbors doing while this was happening?
Oh, that's
and
cool.
A kind of
okay,
thing.
Or, I get it.
Or they
or
could
maybe
say like
it's
yeah.
a musical
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Or
that sounds fascinating. I wasn't quite sure how those puzzle pieces fit together. So thank you for walking us through that. I wish we had more time. I've got one more sort of lightning round for both of you. So just in 10 seconds or less. Starting with you, Megan, what is your greatest fear going into tonight's show? Be honest.
I don't think I'm afraid of anything aside from I can't even imagine what I'm afraid of. Somebody is spilling battery acid on their hands.
Okay, but
which happened yesterday.
What is yours, Sean?
Mine is always that I will be mouthing the words along with the actors while I'm sitting there watching in the audience, because sometimes I have a hard time controlling my face.
Megan and Sean, thanks for coming on the Friday Buzz and Breaking Lake tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, Megan and Sean are the co-directors of Mercury Players Theater, new show Becky's New Car. The play premieres tonight at the Bartell Theater, runs through April 12. More tickets, more info and tickets at bartelltheater.org. Okay, the Friday Buzz, everyone, we're headed now to more arts. It's going to be our first conversation with Samara Kalk, and we're going to get into restaurant trends and things like that. Nobody likes restaurants in Madison, I don't think. You're listening to WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison. Wisconsin is 850.
The tires are the things on your car that make contact with the road. The car is the thing on the road that takes you back to your abode. I get too low with no reason, but say it's the moon or maybe the season, but something's not the same and I can't make my mind believe. Baby, something's wrong, the whole feeling's gone. I can't make it anymore, I can't make it anymore. Lately I don't feel too much like talking.
That's I Can't Take It Anymore. That's a special song we wanted to share with you. It's written and performed by Tom Cooper, otherwise known as the Gentleman Troubadour. You may recognize the fiddle work on that cut. It's by Biff Moyer, formerly of many Madison groups, including the Gomers. Tom just beat stage four cancer, and we want to celebrate his future collaborations with Biff, and we look forward to him playing out again soon. I Can't Take It Anymore is available on all the services, Spotify and whatnot. And so thank you, Tom, and keep it going. All right, it's the Friday Buzz. I'm Andy Moore, segment three. I like to say it's not a small world, it's a small town, but for all her smallness, Madison gets large, very large, when it comes to the restaurant industry. From supper clubs to high-end tapas at neighborhood bars, Madison does, I guess, about have it all. And it's a good thing little old Madison has another thing, a talented food and culture writer named Samara Kalk. Samara reports on these things for the Wisconsin State Journal, and I ask her to join us from time to time to check in on the food scene. Samara, good morning, and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Good morning, Andy.
You know, COVID is in people's rearview mirror in so many ways, but do you think that the service industry, restaurants in general, have recovered in the ways that are that they need to in Madison? What's your view of that?
Yeah, you know, I really think they have, and that COVID's something I don't even talk to restaurant owners about. It's just kind of a sore subject. And, you know, and a lot of restaurants went out of business, certain types of restaurants. It was really the hardest on fine dining restaurants. Mm-hmm. But so many remained, and, you know, still so many are opening all the time. It's kind of the same, you know, schedule of openings and closings that there ever has been. It's just relentless. It never stops. There's always new places opening up, and, you know, we have to always lose some if we're going to gain some. So that's just kind of that ebb and flow of how it goes.
Yes. So we're back to the normal ups and downs of people opening and closings is what I hear you saying.
I really think so. Yeah.
It's a tough way to make a living. Writing about food. It's two art forms, really, isn't it?
Well, you know, I do two different types of writing on food. I do restaurant news, which is always really interesting. And I, you know, pretty much ask the same questions. I want to know what the people's background is and, you know, what the menu's going to be, you know, when they're going to open, if they're doing remodeling. It's always the same kind of straightforward, you know, questions. But with the reviews, it's really tricky because you have to be really, I try to be really, you know, constructive when I criticize, and I try not to be overly critical. So if I have some bad experience at a restaurant, I try to go back enough times to, you know, lead with the positive, because what I've noticed is that you could have a review that's 90% positive and you make a few small critiques, and, you know, that's all the owners focus on. That's all they can remember or all that they think about.
What makes good food writing?
You know, I think it's funny. I did some time abroad like 25 years ago, and I had colleagues fill in for me. And I remember one of them coming up later when I got back and saying, you know, I just ran out of adjectives. Like I just, and, you know, it's funny because when I write a review, I think, you know, I do a search, like, did I use the word excellent? Did I use the word good? Did I use any of these too many times? Like, more than once is too many. You know, you have to just be, you don't want to be repetitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's a little tricky that way. It's tricky to come up with new ways of,
right,
of saying something is really good,
yes,
you know?
I would think so. This is a dumb question, but if you're eating, at a friend's dinner party, can you turn the critic off and give him a break?
Well, I mean, the lamest joke, and every single person makes it when I go to their house for dinner, you're not going to be reviewing this, are you? I can't take it. It's the worst joke.
But let's kind of climb into trends for a minute or two. Things like smash burgers, they came out of nowhere and now they're everywhere. And they come in this, you know, it's an example, I guess. What would you say is trending in the Madison food scene right now?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the smash burger is, you know, sometimes you go to a fairly high-end restaurant and there's the smash burger. And it used to be that people wanted a thick, juicy burger.
Right.
And now it's letting restaurants off the hook. They can just smash it down. They can
I've thought about that.
A small amount of meat, smash it down, and it's like, basically, it's the same size as like a Big Mac patty.
Maybe smaller.
I mean, I prefer it, and I've always preferred like a smaller than a really thick, meaty burger. So it's not a bad trend for me, but I eat only, you know, a few burgers a year. I'm not a huge burger person.
Okay. If I go to
a restaurant that is like a steakhouse or a big burger place, I try to go with a friend who eats more meat than I do, so I can just have a couple bites.
Well, you led me to my next question. This is morose, but you know how they give someone sentenced to die in prison, a death row meal choice. What's your death row meal?
I think about that sometime. Well, my favorite meal is at Bandung. There's a dish called ase chabe. It's like a very kind of vermicelli type noodle with jalapenos, and you can choose your protein. And a friend and I always go to Bandung for his birthday in summertime and my birthday in wintertime. So we're guaranteed to go there twice a year. So that's a big favorite of mine.
Aren't you going to ask me what my death row meal is?
Please.
It's if I was offered a death row meal, I would say I want an all-you-can-eat buffet. And then they keep coming back and say, okay, you ready? And I'm like, nope, I'm going to have some more of the custard and one more stack of pancakes. And they come back and it's like, you ready to go? It's like, nope, it's all-you-can-eat, right?
That is genius.
And then maybe, you know, just keep eating. And I don't know how long they would let you do that, but they you know, the devil's in the details. I want to get to a specific restaurant before I let you go, and I'm sorry we're short on time. I want to, speaking of Asian or Pan-Asian, there's something specific. The Ha Long Bay family is doing a Little China over now on the Near East Side.
Oh, yeah, Little Palace opening up where Mint Mark used to be.
Yes. So that's basically the headline, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I had heard that a long time ago, many months ago.
Yeah.
And I tried to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't talking. And it was really frustrating for me because then I just started to take it personally. Like, why aren't they talking to me?
Yeah.
And then they let that news slip. I don't know, slip, but they put it covertly in a message about how they were having this rummage sale of all these plates and glassware and all the stuff at the little palace in the new Midmar space. So I went over there on the weekend and the owners weren't there, but it was a super sweet employee. Mm. And it was pretty obvious what they were doing. And then I sent the owner, Jacqueline, like 5 emails and no response. And then I thought, maybe I have the wrong email address. But anyway, I wrote the story without her response. I hate to do that, but people are wondering how Long Bay is, you know, my favorite restaurant. I hadn't ever been to Little Palace, but
when they move into Midmar. I don't mean to interrupt you. This very rarely happens, Samara. I'm sorry. We're going to go overtime.
Oh, no.
I don't want to get Chris Powers mad at me.
She finally confirmed it. In the 11th hour, she confirmed it.
Oh, so good. Okay. Confirm. There's the reporter. Yeah. All right. Samara, thank you. I hope you enjoyed our first outing, and will you come back?
Of course. Thanks, Andy.
Okay. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. We're 20 seconds over. This is WRT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, 89.9. Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you have a great damn weekend. Aloha. Kama aina.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Friday, March 28th.
This is Bird Note. Flitting from stem to stem, a yellow bird in a tiny black bandit mask sings with a voice many times his size. Common yellow throats are one of the most abundant warblers in North America. They're adaptable birds, thriving in places that pickier warblers pass over. So it's easy to find yellow throats in urban areas. Check for them in marshes, overgrown fields, and brushy areas along streams or trails. Many people remember the yellow throat song pattern with the phrase, witchetty, witchetty, witchetty. During the breeding season, males may repeat the song an earworm-inducing 300 times an hour. Only adult males have those bandit masks, but females and young males